Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Salman Khan to the broadcast. Sal is the founder and executive director of the Khan Academy, a not-for-profit organization with the mission of providing a free, world-class education to anyone, anywhere. As of December 2013, the Khan Academy channel on YouTube attracted in excess of 1.5 million subscribers, and the Khan Academy videos have been viewed over 334 million times. In 2012, Time featured Sal on its annual list of the 100 most influential people in the world. Prior to founding Khan Academy, Sal was the portfolio manager at Khan Capital Management and a senior analyst at Wohl Capital Management. He also spent time at MVC Venture Capital, Scient Corporation, and Oracle Corporation. Sal received his MBA from the Harvard Business School, where he was president of the student body. He also holds a master's degree in electrical engineering and computer science, and a bachelor's degree in electrical engineering and computer science, and an additional bachelor's degree in mathematics, all from MIT, where he was president of the class of 1998. I recently caught up with Sal at Khan Academy's headquarters in Mountain View, California, and our conversation covered world-class IT principle 4, IT and business partnerships, as Sal spoke of Khan Academy's emergence from an idea to help his cousin learn math to the education juggernaut it is today. The Forum on World-Class IT is brought to you by Red Hat, the world's leading open-source solutions provider. Learn more at redhat.com.
Salman Khan, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT.
Great to be here.
The organization has a very famous beginning with the tutoring of your cousin Nadia and developing some content to help her with math. And as you began to spread that out to other friends and family, or make it accessible to other friends and family, you started to leverage YouTube as a tool, and then began to receive a lot of favorable feedback from strangers. And as I understand it, those were kind of the initial inklings that there was something bigger here. I'm curious, since it grew organically, the very initial part of this was so specific to an individual's needs. As it grew and as you got this feedback, what gaps did you find in the educational space that this was filling?
I mean, the gaps, frankly, probably started even pre-Nadia.
Okay.
Where you know, just going through school myself, I saw plenty smart friends who, you know, we would go home, they would beat me at chess, or they would, you know, whatever. Like, I, you know, they would solve the brain teaser before I would. But then they're struggling in algebra, and just observing that, it was pretty clear that something had happened when they were learning all the classes coming into algebra, where they just didn't have the same foundation. That the math just seemed like voodoo to them, or they had some basic things that they were missing. And I started seeing the exact same things with my cousin, and Nadia in particular. She had actually gotten A's and B's through every math class. She was for the most part a very good student. But here she was entering into seventh grade, being placed into a slower track. And when I started working with her, it was very clear that despite getting A's and B's most of her life, she had some very, very serious gaps in her knowledge and what she was comfortable with that was causing her to have difficulties as math just got slightly more advanced into seventh or eighth grade, which was pretty clear to me that it's just going to turn into a disaster when she gets into high school and then into college. So, and this is the part of the story of the Khan Academy that most people don't realize. The first thing I did wasn't videos. The first thing I did was, you know, my background was in software, and I've always had these kind of romantic notions of starting writing software that could help people learn. So I started writing a little tool that would give Nadia and her brothers and the other people I was working with practice problems. You know, they could literally log in, do practice problems. I didn't trust them when they said how long it took them or whatever else, so I put a database behind it. And that was actually a really useful tool as a tutor, as a coach, whatever you want to call me, because then I could see where they had gaps, I could intervene appropriately, I could give them as much practice as they needed, and they could do it at their own time and pace. And the videos didn't happen until about 2 years later, when I was showing the software to a friend, and he said, "Well, this is all very cool, Sal, but how are you scaling your actual the lesson part?" Because now it was like 10, or, you know, word had gotten around in the family that free tutoring was going on. It was like 10 plus cousins every day. And I said, "Yeah, you're right. I'm not. And he said, "Well, why don't you make some lessons on YouTube?" And the first lessons on YouTube, and you can even search them today, were literally, you'll hear me say, "Welcome to level one negative numbers." And you're like, "What is level?" Well, that was a little software module. Level one negative numbers was a little software module. And this was the thing where if you had if you were having trouble with that software module, you could click on it and you would see a video that was being streamed from YouTube. And I started doing those as to complement the software idea. But as you mentioned, those took on a life of their own. But it reinforced exactly what I saw with my buddies growing up, what I saw with Nadia, what I saw with her, with my other cousins, is that there's a ton of people out there, some of them very good students, some of them think they're bad students. And at the end of the day, what they're really missing is a way to understand where their gaps are and a way to address their gaps. The problem is by the time you're in an algebra class, and if you're a little shaky on decimals, there's no real way to address that. The class is going to move on. The class is going to cover systems of equations. But decimals are your issue. This gave people an outlet. And when I started doing this, I assumed that, okay, maybe this is good for, you know, a 13-year-old version of myself, good for my cousins who, even if they had difficulty, they were for the most part motivated. But maybe this isn't a universal or doesn't apply to 80% of students. But the one thing I found, you know, some of the strongest testimonials that I got back then and I continue to get literally have this template. I thought I was bad at this. I was about to give up. I was about to drop out. I was about to major in something else. And then I realized that it's actually, I just had these very basic gaps. Once I got those filled in, I was able to, you know, do whatever I wanted. In fact, we have a couple of people in the organization who did that. One gentleman here failed calculus 3 or 4 times, dropped out of college because of it. Later became very successful in IT and used Khan Academy to relearn everything because he had an idea for a business where he had to know calculus. And he himself, I mean, he's literally on the other side of that wall. He's now one of our top engineers. You know, for him, he didn't realize he had all these gaps in his formative mathematics. That was keeping him from passing calculus. But now he's clearly one of the most brilliant people that any of us know. It's not about smart, not smart, not about motivated, demotivated. It's a lot about how strong are your foundations and how confident and how good of a perception do you have of yourself.
I'm curious, how much of this do you see as a complement to traditional education as opposed to a potential threat to it or competitive with it in some way, shape, or form? Do you anticipate a point at which Khan Academy or its ilk will change the way in which teaching is done in the classroom, say in K-12 or beyond?
So I definitely don't think we are a threat or competitive to traditional education in any way. You know, when people imagine virtual something, you know, they imagine, okay, Amazon.com versus Barnes & Noble's, Amazon's doing it more efficiently, Barnes & Noble's is, you know, in trouble. We don't believe that you should ever replace physical education, that like an in-person experience. An in-person experience, there's all sorts of intangibles that even in 1,000 years, a computer will never be able to do. I have young kids. My son is 4. I imagine him going to a very physical school with great teachers and peers and all the rest. Where we come in, and whether you talk about this as supplemental or whether you talk about this as a very powerful tool within the environment, let's reimagine what we can do in that physical environment so that it benefits everyone. So it benefits the student, it benefits the teacher, it benefits the parents, it benefits the globe, because kids learn more, it benefits the globe. More productivity, whatever you want to call it, happier human beings. And so for us, it's taking a lens, and you know, I write a lot about this in my book, it's taking a lens and saying, well, where does our current education system come from? This is not the way that humans have always been educated. This is a 200-year-old artifact. It does come out of the Industrial Revolution. There's some very powerful things about it. It was the first time that we really did have mass, low-cost or relatively low-cost public education. Before the Prussians came up with this model, the only people who got an education were the elite, the nobility, and usually only the male elite, the male nobility. So it's a model that to a large degree has served us incredibly well during the Industrial Age and even into the 20th century. But now there is a moment where we can say, well, what is the ideal? Let's go to a fundamental question. What is the ideal experience? And the ideal experience, it's hard to argue with this, is you're in a physical environment. But when you're in a physical environment, you shouldn't just be passive. You shouldn't just be listening to a lecture. You should be interacting with your peers. You should be working at your own pace. You shouldn't be isolated from people who are more advanced than you or people who are less advanced than you. That's a chance to mentor other people and be mentored by others. And so how can you get to this personalized world that's always been viewed as the ideal, but do so in a way that's actually practical, that's logistically possible? And that's where I think the technology comes in, and that's where things like Khan Academy comes in. If the information delivery can happen some other place, well, class time could be used for interacting with each other. If kids can all get, you know, if the computer can give them the right problems at the right time and give the teacher feedback, well, then teachers don't have to use time for homework review. The kids are going to get immediate feedback. And when they come to the classroom, it's all about, hey, I'm having trouble with this. Can you help me with this? Or, hey, let's do a project on this, or let's explore this deeper.
I want to talk a bit about your process, especially in the early stages. So much of it was you. Mm-hmm. And it was a wide array of topics. A lot of it was math-centric, but as it started to go beyond that, what's the process that you have gone through, recognizing that these were a variety of topics, presumably that there were several years in your past in terms of your own formal education within those topics? How did you get to the point where you had enough detail to put together a comprehensive lesson of one sort or another? And I'm also curious, how has that evolved as your business starts to scale, now that you have 4,300 plus micro lessons out there, and obviously you can't be the bottleneck anymore?
You know, in the early days, obviously, at the very early days, it was a direct need for my cousins. Mm-hmm. And then once it started to take off, I'm like, wow, I'm enjoying doing these videos. There seem to be a lot of people who are getting value of it. I started with direct need for my cousins. I started seeing this need. And even back then, I was like, gee, you know, I've got to get other people to help me because, boy, there's so much to do. And on one level, it was true. But on another level, you know, it was just this crazy project. And even like my, you know, closest friends were like, Sal, yeah, okay, well, yeah, I don't really have time, you know, just keep going. So I just kept going and I started realizing, well, it's actually tractable. It's not an impossible thing for even me, just for my cousins or for my family and whoever might happen to bump into it on the internet to, hey, that's pretty good about algebra. Now let me do trigonometry. Now let me do geometry. Now let me do arithmetic. Let me do pre-algebra. And so it kept growing and growing. It was the best of intellectual adventures for me. As you mentioned, I mean, my background wasn't a lot of this stuff, but to teach it, you have to go much deeper. You're revisiting it. You're testing edge cases that maybe you as a student didn't fully digest with the first time you saw it around.
And moreover, you need to put yourself in the place of the youngster.
Yes.
It's not you where you are now with the vast education you've received since, but in the mind's eye of somebody who's 9, 10, 11, 12, whatever.
And, you know, and I've thought a lot about this. Of, you know, I'm not the first person to do this type of thing, to try to make these little video tutorials. I mean, it's an idea that predates the internet. And even on the internet, I'm probably the 500th person who tried to do this. And I think, I don't know, what was the charm of maybe why these resonated with folks? And I really, and I'm not, you know, being faux humble here, I really think it's the way my brain thinks is actually a fairly simple way. And so when I'm making videos, I make that very simple thought process transparent. And people realize that these things that they thought were these hard to understand concepts, actually, if you break them down, if you really go at the conceptual understanding and you really diagram them out, almost nothing is ununderstandable. And so I kept going, and I also viewed it as a challenge. Well, you know, gee, a lot of people need chemistry, so there's a desire. Let me do chemistry. You know, I'm not a formal chemist, but I understood it pretty well. And if I studied a little bit deeper, asked people, maybe I can get to the level of depth that I know algebra. And it took a little time, but I did. I was like, oh, this is just as beautiful, just as elegant. Let me do chemistry. Let me do history. That was literally the Sal in the closet kind of phase. Like, it's, you know, it's called the Khan Academy. And I kind of cringe sometimes because it was literally almost a joke when I called it the Khan Academy, because it was with my cousins. And I was just like, yeah, like, it's me. Like, this is the whole organization. So I'll call it the Khan Academy. And it was kind of funny because Academy sounds very serious and a major institution. And,
right.
And you know, I dreamt maybe one day, but at 2006, it was a joke. But once we became a real organization, so in 2009, I quit my job. In 2010, we set up as a not-for-profit. 2010, we got our first real funding from Gates Foundation, Google. We could get office space, hire up people. And this is, I think, the other thing people don't fully realize about Khan Academy. The area that I hoped to really focus on was kind of back to the first version of Khan Academy. This dream of, can we create a platform that uses software and videos and text and analytics and to really cater the learning to a person to where they need it? So not just a library of videos. And you see it in the makeup of our organization. We're 42 people. Three-fourths are software engineers. And so we started really investing in that. But we also did want to expand the video content, which we didn't view as the core of who we are, even though externally people think that's the core of who we are. We did want to extend the video content beyond me. Obviously, I can't do everything, even for the things I've done. It's probably not ideal for everyone. We want other voices, other ways of thinking. And so we started to bring some people in. The people that we have on Khan Academy today who are not me, we hope have a, you know, they're different enough that it's interesting, but it's a similar sensibility in that it's intellectually deep, it gets you excited about the topic, but it's not just edutainment. You know, it's easy to get someone excited about the topic. You show some computer graphics, but we want you to actually learn the topic. We don't want to say, hey, isn't this so cool how like the universe formed? Now, don't worry. Quantum physicists will understand it. You won't. We'll say, no, this is cool. Now let's actually turn you into a quantum physicist. Actually, we don't have quantum physics, but we do have cosmology. We do have cosmology, so you can learn about the origins of the universe. So we look for people who bring that same sensibility, and we do hope that over the next, hopefully it's over the next 5, 10, 50, 500 years, we can just find more and more and develop more and more of those people. And I want to stress, it's not just videos. It's to create a full, rich, interactive experience that personalizes to the student.
So much of general education technology space right now, and a lot of it's being written, is about the MOOCs and the model of tying together elite institutions and having the most famous professors in these very topics, the people who have the greatest depth and oftentimes Nobel laureates in these various very topics, teaching on those subjects, the subjects in which they're experts. And obviously, yours is a model that's different. As you point out, these are topics and subjects where you and your colleagues have some exposure, but you're not a PhD in any of these things.
Yeah, and sometimes we do get a PhD. You know, Beth and Stephen, who are doing the history, they are PhDs.
Gotcha.
And they are, but we're not dogmatic that they have to be.
Right, exactly. Right. I wonder, how do you compare yourself to the edXs, Udacities, Courseras of the world? Where do you compete? Where do you complement each other? How do you see the difference in your development?
And I don't think the difference is really on who's making the content. And we are talking to some of the leaders in their respective fields. And we hope that, you know, we already have we have Stanford Medical School content on Khan Academy. So it isn't where the content is coming from or who's making it. It's more of how the content is expected to be consumed and how and what it means to consume it. A MOOC, literally, it's a massively open online course. And they'll give you a certificate. And so just based on that, the perception is, wow, this is the Harvard course. This is the Stanford course. And, you know, I think the risk there is, you know, the reality is it's not the Harvard course. The Harvard course, there is something, and I'll stress this goes back to our first question about the physicality. The MOOCs imply, by just the very, very nature of what they are, that, look, you're getting the course online. That maybe the physical is not as important. And I would say that no, the physical is incredibly important. The actual reality of having conversations with your peers at a university about the topic and going into a tutorial and just being in the room with it makes a huge difference. And so I think there's that distinction. The other distinction is it's attempting to virtualize a physical analog. So there is something called a course today that it starts on a certain date, it ends on a certain date. There's lectures, then there's a homework, then there's a project. Then there's an exam, and everyone kind of moves together. That has advantages and disadvantages. The advantage is it does create a cohort-like effect, so it is good. The disadvantage of kind of going together at the same pace is that this still is the kind of, for lack of a word, the Prussian model of education, where anytime you're forcing people together at the same pace, it becomes a filter. It becomes, if anything, the whole thing becomes an assessment. Who can keep up with this pace? You're learning while you're doing the filter. But, you know, and that's why you do see, you know, very high attrition rates in some of these MOOC courses. And the other aspect is, you know, we see ourselves, if you have nothing, Khan Academy can help you learn. But we're never going to say that we are somehow a replacement for a physical classroom. And what we do say is, but if you have a physical environment, we think we can blend into that in a very powerful way. So that's why we've invested really heavily in teacher dashboards, teacher diagnostics. Teachers being able to assign exercises is coming out soon. So to some degree, the teacher could use Khan Academy within their courses. However, the teacher decides to do it. It's not a pre-packaged course for them. It could be asynchronous. We could be in the same classroom. You're working on negative exponents. I'm working on fractional exponents. That's completely okay. So that's where I would draw some distinctions why we're not really a MOOC. Where the similarities, where I'm really excited about it, is, you know, our mission statement as a not-for-profit is a free world-class education for anyone, anywhere. And at a very high level, the MOOCs are accelerating that same idea. That things that access to knowledge that used to be very hard to get at, they're bringing down the energy, the resources you need to have those experiences.
It seems like, at least in your founding, a lot of the curriculum was focused on a period of time and education is not optional. Whereas the MOOCs have, from their founding, been focused on a period in one's education that is optional and getting more and more and more expensive. And thus, it seems to me that to some extent, that's a lever between replacement for that portion of your curriculum that's K through, you're focusing on a period that is not optional. And so they, right. It cannot replace physical, I mean, I suppose with homeschooling perhaps, but it doesn't really replace the traditional.
Yeah, the homeschooling is still a physical experience.
That's exactly right. Right. Whereas a lot of what the MOOCs have been focusing on is the period in time where it may be inaccessible financially and as well as geographically.
And there's a second quick, you know, because we don't go into credentialing.
Right.
You know, we don't try.
Aside from the badges.
Aside from the badges, but we don't, you know, our badges are for you to feel good about yourself.
Right,
it's
right.
a game mechanic, but it's not, you know, we don't say, hey, someone who got the Master Algebra badge on Khan Academy, well, you don't have to go to your algebra class. We don't say that, and we don't believe that. I think with the MOOCs, it is a question. And it's very popular internationally. And if I'm at, you know, the University of Dhaka, Bangladesh, and I already know electrical engineering, but boy, it'll help my resume, especially if I'm going to try to work for an international firm, if I show that I passed the Princeton course in signal processing. And so I think there is a, for a lot of folks, the MOOCs are giving that, which is a credential brand value. It's already showing up on people's resumes, but that's obviously a double-edged sword. Because obviously if you went to Princeton, you won't be so happy that Princeton is showing up on people's resumes based on, so it's a double-edged sword.
You talked a bit about the dashboards that you're developing for teachers and the diagnostics that you're putting together to help them kind of gauge progress and perhaps as an additional aid to determine how the students are doing. What kind of metrics do you keep as you think about whether or not you are on track with the mission you mentioned before and otherwise?
This is something that we talk a lot about within the organization all the time, and we try to measure ourselves by total global learning due to us. You know, which is a great thing to say, but it's like, well, gee, how do you measure that? It's a combination of, well, how many people are using us, and then what's the average learning per user? And if we were to weight the two, and this is probably where we're different than probably a traditional for-profit entity, out here in Silicon Valley, growth is number one. You grow at all costs. That's what drives your valuation. That's you. And growth is important. We want to grow. That means that we're adding value to people. People are telling us about it. But for us, it's really about the average learning per user that we want to maximize. And the way we think about that, well, first, we have to really invest in really strong, for lack of a better word, diagnostic exercises, assessments. Because if we don't have those, then there's no way of really measuring the impact that the videos or the text might have. And so we're doing a very deep push right now on the Common Core. We're working with a lot of the Common Core groups that are to make sure that we're really going deep, really doing it conceptually, that when we in our so that when we you know when we are confident that a student is proficient at something, that you know when we look at the data and there's a high probability that they'll get another problem like that right, that anyone would say, yeah, they probably do understand rational word problems with rational expressions, whatever it might be. We look at how well do we engage the user, how much time they spend. We're always running experiments. 5% of users see different little tweaks to the system to see if it engages them more. We look at what interventions get them to a proficient state faster. Hey, maybe this video helped. Maybe this video didn't. Maybe this article helped. Maybe the solution for that problem helped. And then we don't look at that just that, but then we also look at, well, how do we help them retain it? Because it doesn't matter, hey, you learned it in a day or a week, but it also matters, like, 6 months later, did you still know this thing? And all of that, the beauty of the web is that you can keep track of a lot of this stuff. And we have some of the best analytics people on the planet. I did a very good job of hiring people smarter than myself across the organization. So we have some very, very good people who are thinking very seriously and working with third-party researchers at universities and cognitive scientists to understand, you know, how do we measure learning? And then once we can, are people learning on the site? And then how do we tweak it so that they're learning more and retaining it?
You mentioned, of course, that your mission is to provide a free world-class education for anyone, anywhere. And the key there, of course, is free. And so on the flip side of that, what is the revenue model? How do you see yourself growing? How do you see yourself continuing to be able to afford this unbelievable talent and more of it as you continue to scale the business?
It's an open question. There's a Harvard Business School case about us, about, you know, should Khan be for-profit, not-for-profit? How's it going to generate revenue? And so right now we're primarily philanthropically supported. And I hope that we can always make the argument why we are a good philanthropic investment. Right now our total budget is about the same budget as a medium-sized high school, and we're reaching millions of students, and our budget is only to improve. So I think the social return on investment is, hopefully we can always make the case to philanthropists and foundations that it's worth doing. And, you know, we're able to do experiments and even forward the science of some of the learning. But with that said, as we grow and our budget grows, just me personally, I don't want to have to spend most of my time fundraising as opposed to trying to make the experience on Khan Academy better and deeper. And so, you know, the areas that have kind of started to surface to us, we are licensing content to for the most part, for-profits that are trying to use us in some commercial way. So yeah, you want to license our stuff? It's fine, as long as you know you're using our brand in the right way. We've started to do some brand partnerships. So the most famous one is with Bank of America. If you walk into a Bank of America now, you'll see a little banner where they say Better Money Habits, a partnership with Khan Academy, where they're using our video content on financial literacy and capital markets and accounting and everything else. And then they're adding their own, they're doing their own portal, and then they're leveraging. You know, they said, look, people trust Khan Academy because you guys have built a brand here, and that you're third party, you're not for profit, you're not just trying to. And so we really want to work with you to truly educate our customers. And, you know, I've talked to them a lot. I was really impressed that they genuinely are in this to educate their customers. It's not just some type of a marketing thing. And so we can imagine doing other things like that with other industries that are that there is an education angle could be very powerful for them. I could imagine, you know, we could brainstorm probably 5 or 10 other things that could happen. But mm-hmm. I feel good that in 5 or 6 years, we won't have to be completely philanthropically supported. And I will add, I mean, we never want to, you know, the one thing that we have ruled out, we won't charge for learning. We won't put ads on the site. Like, I would only put ads on the site if it was just like, you know, the electricity is going down. I call that my plan F. Right? Like, that's like of last resort. Right. But hopefully we never have to do that.
What is the average age of people who are participating in your videos and the program generally?
So we think that the data we're getting right now is a little skewed, and we're trying to normalize it because a lot of students, we think, are using their parents' Gmail or even Facebook accounts when they log in. But if we, you know, if we try our best to kind of normalize the data, the average age is probably older than what most people would expect. Probably you probably go into the early 20s. And that's because, yes, we do have a lot of users who are in school. We have a lot of users who are, you know, learning algebra. But some of our videos on credit default swaps or what are Bitcoins or art history or the causes of World War I are very, very, very popular. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of skews things towards an older age group.
As we stated at the outset and has come up a couple of times, this began as a project for your family. And you also mentioned now that you have young kids. And so I'm curious, how do you see introducing your children to Khan Academy? Is this something that you foresee proactively bringing to them? Will you do so when you identify a need?
It's not like a formal program. We have this little, well, I've started working with some very young kids on Khan Academy. My son's 4. It's kind of people 1, 2, 3 years older than my son. To see how it can work with that age group, we normally say Khan Academy starts being kind of interesting for a 3rd or 4th grader. But, you know, starting to work with that, especially if you have, it's so important to have the human in the room that can get beyond where the technology really fails, and we learn how we can fix the technology. Yeah, I hope that in a couple of years, my son goes to a school where Khan Academy is part of the experience to learn a lot of core skills, core, you know, hey, how do I regroup? What does it mean to divide, you know, long division? How does it work? Whatever it might be, kind of those core skills. And what it does is, as we talked about earlier, it's a tool that catalyzes his classroom to becoming an interactive classroom. So even when he's 6 or 7 or 8 years old, he gets a chance to be tutored by his peers, to tutor his peers, to do projects with the teacher, he has time next to the teacher where the teacher, he or she could sit next to my son. And, you know, even if it's for 15 minutes a week, 20 minutes a week, and really kind of do a very personalized intervention as opposed to, you know, 5 days of kind of what we went through when we were kids, where we'd sit in our chair, pretend we're paying attention, and, you know, sometimes look at the clock. And it's just a very unhealthy thing, especially for kids that young, where they want to move, they want to explore. They're naturally curious, and it's almost that the traditional Prussian model suppresses that natural curiosity.
As you've delved more deeply into these topics, do you find yourself engaged in education reform topics to a greater extent than you were historically, just because now you've got more reason to think about, first of all, as a business person, as a father? Are there ways in which, now outside of Khan Academy specifically, that you would suggest that there be education reform?
Just by virtue of what's happened over the last several years, I've gotten much deeper on reform in the broadest sense. Unlike the more politically charged things, I stay out of it. It's not in our interest to pick sides there. You know, I think oftentimes both sides have interesting arguments and something in between is probably the right thing. Who knows? The areas where I and the organization is more vocal is, well, let's rethink the model. Not just the model of how, you know, the day-to-day model of should the classroom be lecture-based or should it be project-based or should it be kids going at their own pace? But also, hey, why can't we have multi-age groups now? And the real thing to talk a lot about, there's a whole chapter in the book about this, is this idea of moving to a competency-based system. So I would put that in the category of reform, that right now we have, for lack of a better word, it's a seat time system. I mean, at the university level, it's blatantly seat time. You get credit hours. They don't say you are competent in, you know, you got this many competency points. They said, no, it's 3 credit hours for, oh, and you could get a C, but you still get the 3 credit hours, right. Which is, and so what I really fundamentally believe is we need to move to a world where it's about competency. What level of competency do you have of algebra? It's not okay to get a C in algebra, but it doesn't mean that you're a bad person or that you're not hardworking or you're not capable. It just means that you need to work on it harder, because no one is benefiting from you getting a C in algebra and then you going and taking algebra 2 or taking pre-calculus after that. It's much better for you to learn algebra at a reasonable level of proficiency. And so I would like to move to a world where you learn how you see fit, it's personalized, et cetera, et cetera. That's one reform that we advocate, and we hope we're a tool to catalyze that. The other reform is we want to see classrooms that are much more human. People interact with each other. That's a reform. And the other is we want to see kind of a competency-based world where it's not, I spent 4 years at University of so-and-so and so. It's, you know, here are the capabilities. I can prove to you that I'm a critical thinker. I can prove to you that I can write. Here's my portfolio of creative works as evidence of this capability.
What was the last lecture that you delivered? Is there one that you have planned right now?
Yeah, the last lecture I made isn't that exciting. It's reasonably exciting, but it's not, you know, I wish I could say, you know, the Napoleonic Wars or, you know, the Mussolini in the 1920s, which there are videos on that. But the very last one I made was literally a worked example of a kind of a Common Core word problem. So not that. There's more fun stuff than that the formation of the Earth and the galaxy, you know, that stuff's also on how Ponzi schemes work and stuff like that. But that was not the last video I made.
And you have one plan.
Plan, you know, I'm in the middle of, we're doing like with the school year about to start, we're just doing a big re-architecting of how the system's going to become more personalized, more interactive. And as part of that, I'm just making sure that we have the content, the interactive content and the video content that fills in all the gaps for students.
Wonderful. Well, Salman Khan, thank you so much for joining us here and sharing your insights and the very exciting journey you and your organization have gone through.
Thanks a bunch.
The Forum on World-Class IT would like to thank Red Hat, the world's leading provider of open-source solutions, for being our corporate sponsor. Red Hat believes in the power of openness and shared knowledge to transform how we all do business. Learn more at redhat.com. Listen to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategies Forum on World-Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World-Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World-Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategies' 5 principles of world-class IT. The 5 principles are as follows. Principle 1 is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The 2nd principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The 3rd principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The 4th principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the 3 prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The 5th and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the 4th principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.